You're listening to the Forging Bio podcast, a show that illuminates invention, not in some distant laboratory, but in the very fabric of our everyday lives. We're sitting down with innovators in biotechnology and biomanufacturing to talk about how microbes and molecules are making the future of industry. We'll hear incredible stories of inspiration, revolutionary ideas, and approaches to creating ingredients for food, beverage, nutrition, pharmaceuticals, beauty, agriculture, materials, and more, all shaping the future of health, wellness, and prosperity. Hello, welcome to our second episode of the Forging Bio podcast. I'm your host, Casey Lipmeyer, Senior Vice President of Innovation at Conagen. And with me is my guest, Casey McCormick, VP of Innovation at SweeGen. Similar names, similar titles. I think of him as my doppelganger. Casey, can you tell us more about yourself?
Sure. Great to be with you this morning, Casey. The way I came to be sitting with you today is I have about a 30-year background in food science. So for those of you who aren't familiar, food scientists are the group of technical professionals who make sure that the food products that consumers eat every day are safe, that they comply with local laws, that they are affordable food products, and that they have the right level of nutrition and cost that make them accessible to consumers everywhere. And I've been doing this work, like I said, for a number of decades. And, you know, I've worked for large multinational organizations where we had $50, $60 billion in annualized sales. And then I worked for very, very small organizations. We were just trying to start a business around an idea where we believed that this idea would help and improve consumers' lives. And we spent a number of years implementing and bringing it to the marketplace. So, you know, I've met a lot of consumers and made a lot of food products that I've introduced into the marketplace.
That's pretty cool. And maybe tell us also a little bit more about SweeGen and how it differentiates itself from its competitors.
Certainly. Say a few things just to introduce the company. So SweeGen, unlike a lot of food companies that consumers are familiar with, the big brands, those are manufacturers. So they're making a product and they're selling it to the consumer. Behind all of those manufacturers is an entire ecosystem of B2B companies. So companies that sell their ingredients and other and packaging materials to these manufacturers. And SweeGen is one of those such B2B companies. So SweeGen is a relatively new company. We've been around less than 10 years. And we made our bones by helping large manufacturers solve for the crisis today of the high levels of sugar in food and beverage products globally. So SweeGen has a broad portfolio of technical tools, sweeteners and flavors, and I think we'll get a chance to go kind of deep on those later. But what they do is they really help give the manufacturers the tools they need to continue to delight their consumers from a taste perspective, but begin to mitigate some of the problematic sugar out of their products and some other challenges as well.
Yeah, I think everybody thinks of sugar as being the problem. Everyone knows sugar's an issue. I myself struggle with it, right? You know, I could lose 20 pounds, and a lot of that has to do with sugar. That'd be great. So does SweeGen basically sell, you know, these other sweetener alternatives, these non-caloric sweeteners across the board, or is there any specific area that it focuses on?
Well, there's a couple of things to say there. The first is, you know, trying to replace sugar and problematic nutrition in food is not a new thing. It's been going on really since the 60s or 70s. But that really started with things like synthetic sweeteners, you know, aspartame. You know, maybe some of the older listeners will remember a product called Tab Cola. You know, it was something that was brought to the marketplace to help people begin to enjoy a cola product, but not necessarily continue to have the sugar. Most of those early technologies, they were derived from synthetic production. So when you hear people talk about, I'm doing air quotes here, I know it's a podcast, chemicals, these are the kinds of materials that they're talking about. How SweeGen distinguishes itself from other, you know, B2B ingredient suppliers is that SweeGen focuses entirely on natural materials. So these would be, you know, chemicals, again, in quotes, that you could find in agriculture, in plants, in the native flora of Western Africa, for example. These are not chemicals made by some scientist in a white coat in a lab. They're rather things that occur in nature and that SweeGen uses various processes to bring them to marketplace. And, you know, we feel that this not only helps resolve some of these challenges around sugar that I mentioned, but it also helps consumers feel closer to the more natural world, which we know is a very important trend to respect for consumers.
Great. So I know that whenever I'm having a quote-unquote diet beverage or some other kind of, you know, reduced sugar food or candy or something like that, it tastes, I mean, if I'm being completely honest, I feel like they all taste kind of weird, right? Mm-hmm. Most of those, I think, probably have artificial sweeteners in them. But it seems to me that a company like yours would really want to make something taste as good as possible. So how do you do that?
Well, this can be a 45-minute answer, and I probably wouldn't still hit all the points, Casey, but I'll try and address at least some of the big buckets that help us understand. Because you're right that, you know, again, artificial or synthetic sweeteners, you know, they replace the sweetness, but not they don't really replace the consumer experience of having regular sugar. And that is one of the things that we try to do here at SweeGen. So, you know, the thing to highlight here is, you know, these tools are, you know, using, again, a singular, often just one or two ingredients that have a level of sweetness that is, again, not representative of sugar in terms of how quickly you taste it, how long the sweetness lasts, or even the aftertaste that it carries. We would refer to that as, here's a technical term, temporal sweetness. Mm. What that is the time intensity of as you consume sugar, how it builds relatively quickly in your mouth and then slowly fades out, and it has a very clean finish. And, you know, synthetic sweeteners, candidly, they don't really respect any of those elements of temporal sweetness. They kind of hit you with a big burst, and then they kind of fade quickly with quite a bit of bitterness. Mm. So again, at SweeGen, because we're tapping into the natural world of molecules, we don't just have one or two things. We actually have a deep portfolio of both sweeteners, so things based around ribosides and some other technology that I think we'll get into later, but also flavoring molecules that can help shape the expression of how you taste things that are sweet. So SweeGen can not only, again, give you a zero sugar experience like the one you described, Casey, but can give you one without all the baggage and aftertaste and call it lack of sugar-like experience that the synthetic sweeteners provide today.
Yeah. And sorry, you used a word there that I'm not sure our listeners might be familiar with. What is a riboside?
A riboside is, I hate to use this word, but it's a molecule.
Yeah, okay.
apologies to the non-scientists out there. But it is a naturally occurring molecule in nature. It grows in a plant called stevia, which I think most sure. people would be familiar with. It's been around for 15 or 20 years in, at least in the North America marketplace.
And, the plant's been around forever. But
been around for many hundreds of years, for sure.
Yeah.
And what most people don't know is it's actually originally from Latin America. You know, today it's cultivated primarily in China and a few other places, but yeah, originally from Latin America. And the leaves of the stevia plant are, when people would consume them, again, many hundreds of years ago, they found that the material was quite sweet. Mm. And that is because these leaves are rich in these materials called ribosides. And there's a number of different ribosides that occur naturally in the leaf, some of which, again, taste very sweet, some of which actually taste terrible. They don't taste sweet at all. But what SweeGen's business model is that we've identified both the sweetest and I will define as the most interesting or tasting ribosides in the stevia leaf, and that our technology allows us to produce those very, very low-occurring molecules from the leaf in very large scale and at very high purity and at very actionable costs for manufacturers. And that what that does is it gives us access to a broad range of materials, but only the specific materials that we have a high level of interest in and the very specific materials that we can use to make into systems for sweeteners or flavors to recreate that consumer experience that I described for you earlier of replicating sugar.
So if I had to sum it up, I think the penny has dropped for me here. It sounds like in nature, some of the more abundant ribosides in the stevia leaf extract have maybe the least desirable taste, but some of the least abundant ones have the best taste. Is that about right?
That's a very fair way to put it, Casey, yes.
Got it.
Yeah.
Interesting. So that helps illuminate some other thoughts for me. I mean, I remember going 10 or 15 years back, like you said, you know, some of the original products that are advertised having stevia in them, to me, honestly, didn't taste that great. And I know my wife agrees with me on this, too, because she's much more sensitive about that topic than I am. But I feel like they've gotten better over recent years. Is that because of this understanding of these rare roboticides?
It's exactly correct. And yeah, I would agree with you and your wife that the product that was brought to the marketplace 15 plus years ago, me as a consumer, I was very excited. You know, a natural product, you know, all the sweetness, none of the calories. And the taste experience just candidly didn't live up to what I'd hoped it would be. And these next generation roboticides have really resolved the majority of those taste issues. There's still some other things we're obviously always looking to improve and doing things to, you know, have that growth mindset. But I will say, though, is because so many people had that negative experience over the last decade before this technology became available, you know, it has altered people's perceptions. So people will, you know, just sometimes assume that all stevias don't taste as well as others. So, you know, there is a bit of an education piece where we're constantly working with our customers who are trying to work with their consumers in terms of how we can use language to kind of help them feel more engaged and feel that not just are you getting, you know, something good for the earth, good from a calorie perspective, but that is going to be delightful from a taste perspective as well.
Got it. So, okay, so we've talked about at least two different kinds of roboticides. I mean, are there more than two? Or what do they call? I mean, how do you tell the difference between them?
They have very simple names. And, they differentiate on a couple different things. First is the number of glucose molecules that they have bound to them. Some have three, some have four, some have five glucoses bound. And then the orientation that they have once they're bound. But the way we divide them up is that we give them very, very simple names. The original one that is very abundant in the leaf is called Reb-A.
And that's the one that doesn't taste so good.
It has its opportunities to taste better for sure.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. So, and that, and again, that has, it's limited in its taste, but it's great in abundance. But some of the ones that that SweeGen focuses on that, again, are, you know, much preferred from a taste perspective, those would be called like Reb-D, which has an additional glucose than Reb-A. So that would have five glucoses bound. Another one that's of great interest is Reb-M. So, and this is one that consumers who've heard of new stevia may be the most familiar with. That actually has six glucoses bound to it. So, you know, what that means is you have a material that is both much more sweet, but because it is by weight so much more glucose, you have a lot less of some of the aftertaste. That, again, also when it's produced at very high purity, mitigates those aftertastes further. And then actually within SweeGen, we've got a variety of other Rebs that people wouldn't be as familiar with that we do use to help, again, make these great consumer experiences, things like Reb-E, things like Reb-I, that, you know, people would really only find about in scientific literature because they're not – other than SweeGen, no one has brought them to the marketplace.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so you guys are sort of the leaders on these novel, rare roboticides, you know, or Rebs.
We're pioneers, Casey.
Okay.
We're pioneers.
Okay, fantastic. Okay, so that's interesting. And so can I also presume that, you know, roboticide M tastes maybe a little bit different than roboticide D and I, and that has an impact, I guess, on how you use them?
Correct. And, you know, I have a large team of other food scientists who work for me, and they have, you know, colleagues in all sorts of discipline of food science. So, you know, flavor chemistry, sensory science, consumer products. And what we actually do is we combine these different roboticides into, you know, what we would call a system. So we would blend a little bit of M, a little bit of D, et cetera, to make products that would, say, make a juice taste juicier. Mm. Or to make a chocolate bar taste, you know, not just more sugar-like, but also to enhance not just the sugar, the sweetness character, but also the chocolate flavor of that product. So we actually take these materials, and because you're right, they have different base sensory experiences, and we combine them in the most optimized way for the consumer experience.
Okay, for each individual application.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so just going back a little bit too, one thing I wanted to clarify, you were saying about how these roboticides are at least in part comprised of glucose, and glucose is just sugar. So, I mean, does that mean that I'm still going to get fat if I eat roboticides?
No, and you won't get fat for two reasons.
Okay.
The first is, you know, unlike the glucose you would eat, like, or you would consume in a, maybe from a sports drink or even from table sugar, these glucoses remain bound to the stevia through...
Oh, so you can't digest them.
You can't digest them, but I would say even if you did digest them, you know, when you consume, say, a 12-ounce soda, you're having 40 grams of sugar in there. So call it 40 grams of glucose. To make the same sweetness equivalent of the same amount of soda, you would have, you know, less than 4 milligrams of stevia. So just the physics of how little glucose is even there, even if you could digest it, it would be calorically negligible.
Right. So that's hundreds to thousands of times sweeter. These Rebs.
Many hundreds of times.
Got it.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess that reminds me also a little bit of these other kinds of sweeteners. I mean, I guess I've heard that phrase high-intensity sweetener used. So is that something that these Rebs are?
Yeah, they would be put into that category. It's a general term that can be referring to some of the synthetic sweeteners that I think we were talking about in the beginning, the ribosides that we're talking about now. And there are some other materials out there that manufacturers use from nature. So things like monk fruit, which is an agricultural product from China, for example. So there are other classes of materials, but the idea is, you know, something that on a weight basis is used very low, but the impact of sweetness to the food or beverage product is very high.
Interesting. So what kind of products does SweeGen make solutions for, if I can phrase it that way? I mean, you mentioned sweeteners, but you also talked about natural flavors. How do those play into it?
Yeah, and it's actually, you know, relatively exciting development for the company in the last few years. So I mentioned earlier that this company is less than 10 years old, and, you know, we came to the market primarily as a stevia company. And, you know, I think some of the things I've described for you in the last few minutes are part of our evolution in that space, how we've, you know, really optimized to sell really great sweetener systems. But, you know, we realize that there's a lot more to great taste than just replacing the sweetness of sugar, that taste has many, many different dimensions. And, you know, it requires an even larger and more diverse toolkit to get there. So SweeGen over the last few years has entered a category of materials we, again, supply to large manufacturers called flavors with modulating properties. So just to maybe give a little bit of context for listeners, if you've heard of natural flavors, you've typically heard of them maybe like a natural flavor that's added to an orange juice. That's where there's some, you know, obviously orange juice makes up the product, but they put a little extra orange juice, quote, flavor in there, and that's, you know, they've extracted a little bit of oil from an orange and mixed it with some other materials just to make that orange juice. So whether you consume it, you know, in March during orange juice harvest or in the fall after the oranges have been sitting around for 6 months, you kind of always manage that same consumer experience. To be clear, I'm not talking about that.
Okay.
Those are what's called tonal flavors. Those are flavors that taste like an orange. They taste like a strawberry. They taste like chocolate.
Sure.
At SweeGen, we focus on something, again, called flavors with modifying properties. And these are flavors that they don't actually taste like, you know, a fruit or something else. What they do is they help and enhance the way you taste products.
Oh, so, okay.
So
do they have a flavor of their own?
They don't. They don't have an aroma. You know, I have a flavorist who works on my team and develops a lot of these products. And he always tells me, I spent 25 years training my nose to build flavors, and now everything I do doesn't have a smell.
How tragic.
Yeah, exactly. But just to give a simple example, again, we've talked about soft drinks a few times, and soft drinks often contain a medium to high level of caffeine. Caffeine as an additive in a soft drink is quite bitter, you know, and one of the reasons why some soft drinks have the level of sugar that they do.
Oh, is to mask that.
Exactly. I actually say sugar is the original flavor modifier. You know, if a product doesn't taste that good for its functional ingredients like caffeine, put a little more sugar in there and it's all good.
Same reason why a lot of people put sugar in their coffee, for instance.
It's exactly the same reason.
Yeah.
And, you know, other than, you know, the global epidemic of type 2 diabetes and obesity, it's not a problem.
other than that minor point. Yeah.
But here we are, and this is my challenge to solve. So, you know, in the case of colas or coffee, where again people are adding sugar to kind of overcome the bitterness, we actually have natural flavors. You would add it to the coffee or add it to the cola, and what it does is it will actually modulate or depress the bitterness expression.
Oh,
so without making the product sweeter, you will taste less caffeine, you will taste less bitter. And that's what flavor modulation is. It's basically sending a slightly different signal to your brain mm-hmm. about what you're consuming.
Right.
And then you perceive the things the consumer wants, less so the things that are detrimental.
Well, that's really interesting. So, you know, I like to drink my coffee black, just to use that example again. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's pretty bitter. I drink it black because I don't want the sugar in it. And I think that's true of a lot of people. So you're saying that there's ingredients out there that I might be able to add to the coffee that wouldn't change the flavor of the coffee, but make it less bitter. I guess that is changing the flavor, but not in the same way as like sweetness would.
Yeah, well, actually, the ideal is that you actually bring the more classic flavors of the coffee, you know, the roast notes, the bean notes, et cetera, forward. Because again, sometimes, especially in very dark roasts, you know, sometimes the caffeine is fighting the roast flavor.
I see.
And if you can modulate that out, you actually have, you know, a more clean, true coffee experience.
So what do you call these kinds of compounds, like if I was going to look for them?
Well, you wouldn't find them anywhere except on the ingredient legend as natural flavor.
I see.
These are things that, you know, we were talking about usage rates before. These are things that are, you know,
minuscule.
We're talking parts per million, even parts per billion.
I see.
Into the consumer experience. But again, they're all rooted in the core sui gen belief of finding materials from nature, mm-hmm. scaling them up, and using them to shape the consumer experience for the better.
Right.
So these are materials that we have approved both here in North America as well as around the world.
When you say approved, you mean like FDA regulatory approvals or something like
well,
that?
Well, yeah. Regulatory is, a relatively complex topic.
Sure.
But, you know, here in the United States, there's primarily two bodies that would be specific to our materials. So the first is, the FDA. So those ribosomes I described earlier, they all have FDA approvals. And then there's another organization called FEMA, which is the Flavor Extract Manufacturers Association. And when I talk about natural flavors, that's the body that oversees and qualifies materials to be sold as natural flavor. So we do work closely with those regulators as well as different regulatory bodies around the world. Mm. But here for North America, when we talk about natural flavors, we're talking about things that have to be qualified by FEMA.
So Sweden's got, again, a lot now of sort of different flavor. Yeah, I think you called them flavor modulators before.
Correct,
right?
Correct.
And of course, the sweeteners, and you've got multiple regulatory approvals now across the globe for all of these things. Sounds like a lot to juggle. And so your supply chain has to be pretty complicated as well, too. Are you able to source all of these as easily as you might want?
Well, you know, I think supply chain is always going to be, the last 5 years is always going to be an evolving topic, right? I think no one looks at supply chains the same way here in Q1 2024 that they did in Q1 2020. In fact, you know, it's, you know, we're probably going to, we should probably anticipate a bit of maybe overcorrection. You know, we've seen in different industries outside of food. I mean, look at the onshoring of microchips here in North America. I mean, it's, you know, multi-billion dollar investment, both private and governmental. You know, today we are able to match all of our customers' demand with our factory. We do have a factory today in Asia. We are actively scaling up a factory that the company has in Eastern Europe. And we are actively engaging with a few other potential business partners, specifically here in North America, to also have the capability for local production of these materials as well.
Okay. Sounds like you're on top of it then. That's good to know. So just changing subjects a little bit, or actually maybe I should stay on it before I do that. As far as flavor modulators, or sorry, taste modulators are concerned, I mean, is it just about reducing these bitter flavors, or are there other aspects to that?
Oh, there's so many more aspects to it.
I'm glad I asked.
And in fact, it's actually, you know, one of our, and maybe we can get into this a little bit, you know, one of our most emerging technologies has opened up a new line of flavor modulators for us that we've been very excited to bring to the market, and that we've had overwhelming support. So we've recently launched a line of products called Sweetensify. So these are flavor modulators, and they're all based around the use of a material called brazine. So for you non-food geeks out there, brazine is the name of a very small peptide that occurs in a fruit that is indigenous to West Africa called the ubuli fruit. What makes brazine special is it, despite being a peptide, it is, we were talking about how sweet some of these materials are. Brazine is 2,000 times weight sweeter than sugar.
Oh, okay. So, even more than these Rebs that you were talking about.
Correct. And there's a number of other things that make it interesting. Despite being a peptide, it's quite resistant to acid, which is very, very important in food safety and in food product design. Same thing with heat. Again, often used to reduce bacteria to make a food product safe. You know, it can sometimes be problematic for peptides, but in the case of bronzine, it is not so. But what makes bronzine really interesting and really compelling as a flavor ingredient is the way it actually affects your sweet receptors. So, you know, a lot of these high-intensity sweeteners that we talked about earlier, they actually, one of the reasons they don't taste as much like sugar is they don't hit all the same sweet receptors that sugar does.
How many sweet receptors are there?
There's actually only two.
Okay.
So, and it's about which ones you hit and where you hit them.
I see. If you hit the same one with the same molecule, maybe it wouldn't hit in the same way or something? Or
well, exactly. Okay. Exactly. So what I've come to learn, I didn't know this 10 years ago, is that you know, these high-intensity sweeteners have an affinity for one particular sweet receptor called the T1R2.
Okay.
But when you consume sugar, when you consume table sucrose, it actually affects both the T1R2 and the T1R3 sweet receptor.
Okay.
So what that means is that even when you're working with, you know, my, you know, very high value-added ribosides, you're still not stimulating all the sweet receptors in the same way. So when we bring bronzine into the equation, now we can engage all the same sweet receptors that sugar does. So what it means is I can make a flavor using this material, using bronzine. And, you know, imagine a lemon-lime soda where you could reduce slightly the amount of sugar in it. You would add our sweet Sweetensify flavor. And not only does it taste like the full sugar version, it actually tastes like more lemons and more limes.
Oh, okay.
Because you're actually able to stimulate the flavor delivery.
I see.
So it's not just about sometimes canceling problematic materials out. This technology allows us to sometimes boost the positives. Mm. So, you know, we've had great success with things like I mentioned, citrus fruits, but also red fruits, so raspberries, strawberries, but even into other things like chocolates.
Okay.
So, you know, where you would actually be able to add this natural flavor, it doesn't taste necessarily, the product doesn't get sweeter despite bronzine and its 2,000 times sweetness equivalent, but you actually get this great enhancement of chocolate flavor in the product simply through the introduction of this this natural flavor.
Got it. Yeah. So something else that occurs to me is that with these super powerful sweeteners we've been talking about, again, going back to my wife, she complains that she can never find a cookie, for instance, or some other kind of baked good that, you know, has, you know, no sugar in it. And she's looking for some reduced sugar cookies. And why are those so hard to find?
Sugar has many purposes in food and beverage products. So, you know, and it's a lot more than just sweetness. It oftentimes it actually provides what we would call bulk.
Mm-hmm.
So if you make a sugar cookie, 30% of the cookie at least is sugar. So if you take it away, you've got to replace it with something else. And sugar also has the added challenge there that sugar is one of the least expensive ingredients in a food and beverage product. So
right.
To replace the sugar, you know, it's going to be something that's going to have slightly different taste, but it's also going to cost the manufacturer more money. And then sometimes that means you have to pass that cost on to the consumer, and then the consumer is paying more money for sometimes a lesser experience.
I see. So it's both an economic and a flavor challenge to replace that. Okay.
In the case of you know, food and beverage products, both specifically in beverage products, we see that problem to a slightly lesser extent than the cookie example we just had. But, you know, sugar actually adds quite a bit of body and thickness to a beverage. You know, if you would compare a Coke versus a Diet Coke, you're just going to feel that syrupy thickness in your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So in the case of beverages, we actually do have flavor technology that allows, you know, you could remove 4, 5, 6% sugar from the product. You could replace that with a flavor with modulating properties, and actually replace that thickness and that syrupiness in
your
mouth.
The way it feels
in
your mouth.
Just from a feel. Correct. Just the feelness, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I mean, because all of that, I guess, is part of the sensory experience. And, you know, consumers will notice those differences and make purchasing choices based on that. So it's interesting. It's really important, I think, to always try to meet consumer expectations or try to market, you know, towards those. And a particular way. And that actually leads me to the point that I was going to segue to a moment ago. There's a lot of innovation in food and beverage that I think all of us are seeing every day. Something that's really topical right now, of course, are some of these more sustainable, high-protein foods that we're seeing coming out. The famous example that I like to use is, you know, Impossible Foods, burger. I think that's a great product, but, you know, they've got a really interesting ingredient where they're trying to make some of the protein components taste just like it does in a beef burger. And I know that they had a huge challenge in formulating that, but now there's all these other products out there that are coming on the market that are trying to do similar things. And each one of them, I imagine, requires its own particular massive amount of food science to make it taste right. So could you tell us a little bit more about how the protein angle works in all this?
The area where we see the greatest overlap, because I would actually agree, as a macro trend, there's a few things going on in the consumer marketplace. And I think consumers increasing awareness and affinity for protein, first of all, just the overall content claim of, you know, how much protein is in my product, and the desire to have more seems like something that is, almost unending. I was a part of this for the last 10 years of my career. So we work actually with a lot of manufacturers who are getting into the protein shake business. And there's a couple different kinds. You know, if you go to the vitamin store, you see the things where you put it in a little shaker and you add some water and you shake it up. And then there's, you know, quite a bit of things that you can either get in the, you know, a regular aisle in the supermarket or in the chilled case. And they're all about giving consumers quick and easy access to high levels of protein.
Right.
I think, you know, there's a number of different, obviously, sources of protein. But the one maybe I'll just give an example to your question is pea protein is one that has become quite interesting to a lot of consumers over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I've had raw pea protein, and I got to say, I'm not sure I like it that much.
Yeah. Well, I think most consumers would agree, which is the sort of the one thing holding the category back. Because, I mean, think about it. Peas, you know, you get something. It's a very basic agricultural product. We've got more than enough land to grow it. It's just about really. So, I mean, the economics are there. It's just about really solving for the taste experience. So, you know, within our Taste Code line of flavors and modulating properties, we do have a number of tools that, again, we talked about the ability to modulate out some of these off notes, where those off flavors that come from high levels of pea protein, which I would describe from a sensory language perspective as cardboard or stale cardboard. sensory scientist's words, not mine. We actually have technology that specifically modulates that out. And what that means is, again, now these products do not have to add as much sugar to overcome the off notes from the pea. They don't have to add as much of their vanilla or chocolate flavors that they were adding just to cover up the taste of the pea protein. They can, through our flavors with modifying properties, just basically modulate out those cardboard notes that come from pea protein.
Got it. So I've got a little, part of the reason why I asked the question is because I have a little factoid in front of me that I wanted to share with you to set up my next question. So according to some leading marketing report that was done in 2022, of the consumers who say that they regularly check nutritional labeling, the information that they're most likely to check is for protein and sugar content. And so some of the formulations that you've talked about for reducing total sugar, I think obviously have a nutritional angle. You know, you're eating less sugar. But it's also, I think, important, and consumers recognize, to maybe, you know, increase their protein content. But as we said, some of these proteins don't taste so good, especially some of the vegetable proteins that come out there. So, you know, according again to this survey, it seems that customers prefer, to put it in their own words, functional food and drink over supplements because they're deemed tastier, more affordable, safer, and more convenient. And so, to me, it seems like some of these taste modulation solutions you're bringing to the protein world are also going to have a pretty important health impact that isn't directly related to the flavoring, but to the fact that people can now consume more protein happily, right?
Correct.
I mean, it's kind of a yes or no question, but
correct.
Something worth putting out, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, the one dimension of something we haven't brought up, Casey, though, I think when you talk about this category where my mind immediately goes, that I thought this would be a good point to reference it, is... you know, I mentioned earlier how inexpensive sucrose is, at least historically.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what I'm talking about, I'm describing, you know, new technology, disruptive technology. And, you know, if you remember what, you know, what the iPhone 1 costs versus the iPhone 2 versus the iPhone 3, you know, as technology scales, it goes down and cost becomes more accessible. And, you know, the company has been around now long enough, and our economies of scale and manufacturing, while they continue to increase, you know, they've gotten to the point now where, you know, we can offer our customers solutions where, hey, listen, here's some, you know, here's a sweetener solution, here's an FMP solution.
Yeah.
And not only are you generating that exact consumer target that you described in terms of high protein, low sugar, we're actually able to do it in a manner that the actual cost to the manufacturer is lower with our solutions than if they made the same product with just sugar.
Okay.
So I think that it's really important to note that, because, you know, in the end, consumers, you know, even this survey you reference, in the end, they still shop with their pocketbooks.
Yep.
They can be aspirational. I want to eat this. You know, they always say, I want to eat less donuts. But, you know, every time I go back to the Northeast, there's always more and more Dunkin' Donuts.
Absolutely.
Everywhere. So somebody's not telling the truth there. So the ability to offer these great consumer experiences, but also at something that's going to be actionable from a cost perspective, both for the manufacturer as well as for the consumer, it's very, very important, a part of the business equation.
Yeah. I think most people, when they're answering surveys, for instance, they want to present an aspirational version of themselves in terms of their buying habits. But I think the reality is, just like what you said, people generally shop with their pocketbook, but they also are going to shop for what tastes good. I mean, I'll be completely honest. I'm a snacker. And I've got a lot of respect for food scientists like yourself. So I'm one of these people that goes down the chips aisle, and I'm looking for, like, the most unique-looking flavored chip that I can possibly find. I want to get the pizza-flavored chip. I want to get the pickle-flavored chip. I'm that guy. I'm that consumer. And so, you know, a lot of these food science but with that said, I'm also trying to think about health, right? And so, again, I don't see so many, you know, protein-based chips out there that taste like a barbecue pizza. But I'll tell you what, I'd buy it if I could find it. What can you do to help us out with that?
Well, again, I only offer solutions, B2B solutions, so I can't influence
okay.
the Frito-Lay company
Got it.
To make that kind of chip. But if they were to go down that path, I would certainly have more than a few interesting solutions
yeah.
to help them nail it.
Okay, perfect. All right. So maybe just going back in time a little bit, how did people used to try to address these sorts of challenges in food and flavoring science? I mean, it sounds like you've got some pretty modern solutions, but I kind of want to get a sense of the trajectory.
Well, I mean, I would say it's still a relatively recent challenge. I mean, you go back to this country post-World War II when the majority of the population was undernourished.
Mm.
And again, if you'll look at public health trends, and I'll cite things like heart disease, obesity rates, and type 2 diabetes rates, you know, over the last 20 years, they've gone on a cataclysmic spike.
Right.
And this is something, you know, it's a public health crisis. It's a crisis in terms of, I think, you know, U.S. GDP is about $1.7 trillion is spent on treating obesity and the related systems. So,
yeah.
you know, it's something that has really, really taken off quite a bit. And there's a number of different things going on in the pharmacological world that are also trying to address this. But, you know, food science was pretty traditional and boring until probably the 1970s on this kind of topic. And that's when a product called saccharin first
yep.
came to the marketplace.
Everybody knows saccharin.
You know,
yeah.
And that's when companies who were B2B companies started to actually partner on to brands. So people may remember the name NutraSweet.
Yep.
And then about 15, 20 years later, they may remember how Splenda, you know, you would buy a juice drink or a soda and it would actually have the Splenda logo on there. In the end, I think consumers weren't too enthralled by that. So most of those activities kind of stopped. But, you know, and that was really in the 20th century. It was very much a synthetic chemistry game.
Yep.
And, you know, what it did, this has, been transformative in terms of the number of consumers who were, having products with this. But it's clear that there are still a huge number of consumers who aren't being reached, and there still needs to be a transformation. So, again, our technology is, you know, less than 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But it does synchronize with this last spike over the last 15, 20 years in terms of the obesity epidemic, both here in the United States as well as abroad. You know, things,
yeah.
you know, the Middle East, Latin America, countries and regions that 20 years ago obesity wasn't a thing is now becoming a very large pressing problem in these countries.
It's got to be a pretty satisfying job you have, just on a maybe a, if I can say it this way, a spiritual level, being able to make products that make people healthier and help them reduce their risk of diabetes and heart disease.
It is. It is. I think that the food industry has, and rightfully so, taken quite a bit of criticism for those exact conditions, mm-hmm. I described. Again, 80 years ago, this country was malnourished, and yep. the food industry did this amazing thing. They built this amazing supply chain. They built all this refrigerated distribution.
Well, even innovations in agriculture, too.
Yeah. I was just exactly going to go. I mean, they invested in the farmer, and they fed and nourished this country, and they did it. But at a certain point, they just kept going.
Yep.
And there's, and candidly, there's probably not a lot of CEOs of food companies out there who are sitting around saying, you know what we're going to do next year? We're going to sell less food.
Right.
We're going to make less money. It's just not happening.
Right.
So, the fact that we can be a part of solutions that allow, that allow consumers to continue to be delighted and enjoy the food they eat, but knowing that we're for the net benefit from a public health perspective.
Sure.
Yeah, I get up every day and I feel great about
that.
Yeah,
and companies can still make a little bit of money in between. So it sounds like a perfect fit of all the different things. So, going back to kind of the old way of doing things, I might be a bit of an outlier in being one of these guys that looks for the most technologically enriched foods that I possibly can. Mm-hmm. I know that maybe, there's a larger body of consumers out there that have more of an emotional connection to their food. I guess my connection's emotional too, but in a different way. I think people like to think about the old way of making food and are kind of attracted to that. So how do you bridge those two worlds in your role? How do you do that?
Well, a lot of it is, I think what you hinted at there is, there's an emotional element to it as well. And, I think we've talked quite a bit about the products that my company makes. One of the things is that we offer a lot of services to our customers as well. I mentioned sensory science. We have a broad range of services that we offer to help our customers understand their consumer. The other piece, though, is marketing research and how we understand how consumers interact with our products. So, what we've learned is that we can partner with large manufacturers. We can help them shape the messaging for their material. So, I've talked a little bit about what these things look like on Ingredient Legend. That's not where consumers really spend their time shopping. They'll look at the nutrition fact panel. Again, we talked about look at their levels of protein, sugar. I'd love it if they were also looking at fiber. But what our products allow you to do is to make certain health claims on the front of your package. So things like nutrient content claims. Again, the guys who want to be able to claim high levels of protein, but also things that are very important to consumers, such as no or low added sugar, that they found through, again, everything we do is natural. So the ability to say, hey, listen, we're not just delivering these benefits. We're doing it through a claim of through no artificials.
Right.
These are the kind of things that, again, allow the consumer to build an emotional connection with their food. So it's not just about what's in it from a nutrition perspective, but also to have that emotional connection.
Yeah, and that's why you're going to nature to make a lot of your flavors. And
yeah, and I think what would actually make that example I gave shine a little brighter is to talk about, maybe some examples without naming names of some of the customers that we've worked with. So, we have a number of customers who are trying to revitalize, call it love food products from the 50s and 60s that, maybe by today's standards don't measure up nutrition-wise. So think about things like, gummy candies or chocolates or, certain flavors of soft drinks. So, and this would be characterized from a consumer perspective as these are sort of nostalgia type products. So,
okay.
Gummy bears that don't have sugar, but you still have that exact same experience.
Still tastes like a gummy bear,
exactly.
Looks like a gummy bear.
You can have it.
Been eating them since I was 5 years old.
Takes
right.
you back to your, exactly, takes yeah. you back to your five, but you don't have to worry about gaining a little weight now that we're not 5 years old anymore.
Right.
So, those nostalgic type products. So we have a number of customers today, and again, they're working with our flavors with modulating properties. They know these as a part of a part of our portfolio called Taste Code, where, again, we're able to offer very specific flavors with modulating properties depending upon the specific taste challenge. We've kind of cracked the code there. The specific taste challenge that they have, we're able to offer them very specific products for their solutions so that their consumers are delighted.
Yeah. It's about delighting your consumers. Absolutely. You want things to taste good. You want them to be affordable. And again, you want to be able to make that emotional connection that you were talking about. Sounds like you guys are pretty well on top of it. So just to close us out, success stories are always inspiring. Maybe you could share a couple of examples of successful products that you guys have formulated and we'll end it there.
Sure. And I'll talk to some of the areas that are different than some of our prior talking points. I think, we've talked a little bit about cookies and sodas and things like that. But we've helped a number of different manufacturers solve these kind of problems before. So, we're very proud recently, the last few years, we've helped a number of large manufacturers who are in the juice industry. So, as you guys know, juices by their nature oftentimes have while they have some of the health benefits of the fruit from which they come, they also sometimes contain quite a bit of simple sugars in there. So we have a number of customers who, they're able to, balance some of the nutrition and nutrients that come from their juice blends with some of our natural sweetening and taste, flavor modulating taste solutions to help them get to the right consumer experience. But not have the micronutrients from their fruits be diluted then by the mm-hmm. high level of calories from sugar. But maybe even less obvious to consumers would be some of the more problematic areas where sugar hides. So I think one of the most prominent categories is in condiments. So, I'm sure everyone listening is not too bashful about layering on some ketchup onto their French fries or their cheeseburger, et cetera.
Right.
Depending upon different brands and regions of the world, ketchup is typically about 20 to 30% sugar by weight.
Oh, that's a lot more than
I thought. Yeah, it's actually almost, it's more than soda has on a weight basis.
Hmm.
So,
what about other condiments? I mean, is it in all of them?
It depends on what it is. Certain salad dressings can have anywhere from barbecue sauce is actually the worst.
Oh, is it? Huh.
A really good barbecue sauce will have anywhere from 35 to 40% sugar by weight. So,
wow.
It's similar to those sugar cookies we were talking about earlier.
Right.
Obviously, a lot more smoky, but just as much sugar. So, we have a number of customers in that arena who, we've either helped them solve their problems or we're actively helping them work to solutions today. But I thought even another one, we were talking about baked goods. That people wouldn't realize, things like wheat breads.
Oh, yeah.
Wheat bread, bread is bread.
Wheat bread is healthy bread.
Correct. But, because the wheat itself is quite bitter and has quite a bit of sour taste. I mentioned, a little while ago, sugar is the original flavor modifier. So if you pick up most large nationally distributed brands of wheat bread, you'll find, not a lot, but a few grams of added sugar in there. And it's not in there to necessarily make the product sweeter. It's added just like how people add a little bit of sugar to their coffee.
To reduce the bitter, yeah.
They add just a little bit of sugar to their wheat bread to balance out the bitter. So again, we have very good relationships with those manufacturers and provided them some natural flavor solutions that allow them to replicate that same exact experience on shelf, but without any of the added sugar.
Sounds like sugar's lurking everywhere. So thanks again, Casey, for all of your efforts in trying to reduce it and illuminate those shadows. This has been a wonderful podcast. If our listeners would like to connect with Casey McCormick, they can do so at sweegen.com, SWEEGEN.com. And thanks for tuning into this episode of Forging Bio. I've been your host, Casey Lipmeyer. Visit our website at forgingbio.com, where you can listen to every episode and connect with our guests. Together, we're forging the future of biotechnology.